In 1950, the activist Audre Lorde, who often wrote and spoke and acted for justice for black women, for lesbians, she wrote a different sort of poem titled Memorial One. She wrote, "If you come as softly as the wind within the trees, you may hear what I hear and see what sorrow sees. If you come as lightly as threading dew, I will take you gladly, nor ask more of you. You may sit beside me, silent as breath. And only those who stay dead shall remember death. And if you come, I will be silent, nor speak harsh words to you. I will not ask you why, now, nor how, nor what you knew. We shall sit here, softly, beneath two different years, and the rich earth between us shall drink our tears." Between the lines of that poem, I hear the caution that when someone is suffering, if you do not come softly, lightly, silently, then an opportunity to offer comfort may likely be missed. Lorde's poem reminds me of the Jewish practice of sitting Shiva. That word Shiva comes from the word seven. So of sitting practice for 7 days when an immediate relative dies, a parent, a sibling, a spouse, a child. The practice of sitting Shiva creates time and space to be present to one's grief. And that 7-day window is an invitation for friends and family members to offer a ministry of compassionate presence, of simply showing up. My training in counseling and spiritual direction similarly cautions against presuming to ever say, "I know how you feel." And instead to recognize that each individual is an expert in his or her own pain and suffering and experience. Each individual is an expert in his or her experience. You may get close. I mean, one of the reasons support groups work is people with similar experiences can often help one another, but it's still not a one-to-one correlation that only the individual is an expert in their suffering. And realizing that I can't be an expert on someone else's interior life can be liberating. It can free me. It can free you to practice what Buddhists call beginner's mind, in which you try to let go of feeling like you need to know the right thing to say, the right thing to do, that you need to know how someone else feels, and give yourself permission simply to be present, softly, lightly, even silently. But sitting in caring, compassionate silence beside a longtime friend or loved one is not the only kind of silence. The poet Billy Collins, in his poem titled Silence, says it this way. "There is the sudden silence of the crowd above a player no longer moving on the field, and the silence of the orchid. The silence of the falling vase before it hits the floor, and the silence of the belt when it is not striking the child. The stillness of the cup and the water in it, the silence of the moon and the quiet of the day far from the roar of the sun. The silence when I hold you to my chest, the silence of the window above us, and the silence when you rise and turn away. And there is the silence of this morning," Colin writes, "which I have broken with my pen. A silence that had piled up all night like snow falling in the darkness of the house. The silence before I wrote a word, and the poorer silence now." Or in the words of a teacher of contemplative practices, "Not all silence is the same. There is the awkward silence of the road trip that's a little too long with someone we don't know quite well enough. to be silent next to, there is the refrigerating silence of hardened anger, the reverential silence of dogwoods in winter, the vast silence of a cathedral, the focused silence of absorption in sewing or knitting or a good book, the stunned silence of seeing the status of our pension fund. Now, each of those features physical silence, the technical absence of sound waves, but this silence is merely the outer form of inner dynamics. In young adulthood, when I first began exploring the diversity of the world's religions, I had my first extended immersion into silence among the Zen Buddhists, who invited me, "We're glad you're here. Come, sit on this cushion, face this blank ball, and we'll get back to you in about 45 minutes." "Just sit," they said. As the book title goes, don't just do something, sit there, right? My next forays into silence were among the Quakers, who invited me into an hour of silence in which the speaking was only to emerge, right? They're technically the Society of Friends, but they're called the Quakers because you're only supposed to seek if you feel something quaking inside you that compels you to speak because it would be for the good of the whole. Or as it was taught to me, let the next words from your mouth emerge from your best self, else remain silent. As I continue to experiment with 5-minute and 20-minute and 45 or 90-minute long meditation periods, I began to feel a shift inside myself as I did these consistently. At my best, I was doing 45 minutes twice a day, kind of once in the morning and once in the afternoon. That afternoon's the hard one because you have to actually stop in the middle of your doing and recenter yourself. But as I committed to those increasingly consistent periods of meditation, I began to feel a shift inside myself, like those times in silence were dropping an anchor into the earth, such that when the storms of life inevitably arose, I found myself more grounded than I had been when I had met similar situations and when I wasn't experimenting with those interior journeys into silence. In my mid-20s, I began to explore the contemplative side of the Christian tradition, including some 5-day silent retreats at monasteries. For 5 days, I would have no access to television, cell phone, radio, computer, any of those technological distractions that pervade our modern life. I also didn't know, especially the first few monastery retreats I did, I didn't know anyone else, and all the other retreatants and monks had vows of silence, either temporary or permanent. And at first I wondered, how am I exactly going to spend the time? This is a little qualitatively different than just spending 90 minutes in silence. I was worried that I might be bored out of my mind, and that's actually part of the point, to bore you out of your monkey mind. And I found the actual experience to be both scary and liberating. I took long walks on the surrounding land. And another part that I actually didn't anticipate in advance is I got plenty of sleep. I had time to read leisurely and eat slowly. Most importantly, in the silence, I found myself in a time of what some spiritual teachers called recollection, some time just to review and recollect where you found yourself and how you got to this point. 5 unbusy days in a row. Think of the last time you had that. And that's not even vacation necessarily, right? Some vacations are very like doing, doing, doing. Like 5 totally unstructured, nothing on your calendar, 5 days in a row. Monks vow, certain types of monks, not Franciscans, right? They're out in the world, but some monks, part of their vows are stability, right? They commit to a place. So 5 unbusy days in one place, not driving anywhere, it's pretty rare. To give you a glimpse also into the rhythms of monastic life, the monks at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, so Sea Raven shared with you earlier a quote from Thomas Merton and some about what he discovered as he entered into silence and how that led him, even as a contemplative, to try to do social justice. But Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky is where Merton was, so I spent a week there back in maybe 2002. They rise at 3:15 a.m. every morning. That's usually when they have to be in the service. I don't know what time they actually get up. Maybe like 3 a.m. and just put on your robe and let's go pray, I guess, right? And while getting up at 3 a.m. sounds terrible, at least to me at first, if you get in the habit of going to bed at 8 p.m. because you don't have like Netflix to watch or, you know, it's actually not so bad. It's manageable. And one advantage of getting up so early is that I came to see that many monks have essentially 6 hours of time, sort of like 3 a.m. to 9 a.m., every day of their life that's relatively unstructured for reading, for studying, for meditating before they begin their work duties of the day, typically in mid-morning. That's an expansive amount of time for self-care and spiritual growth every day that most of us non-monastics could never come anywhere close to touching. And that's one reason I've found it helpful to study monastics, that they do have insights to teach us. And if you're interested in learning more about monastic life without actually having to become a monk or a nun, in whatever tradition, one of my favorite starting points to recommend is a book called An Infinity of Little Hours, 5 Young Men and Their Trial of Faith in the Western World's Most Austere Monastic Order. It tells the story of 5 novices seeking to be part of the Carthusian Order. It's like if they set the TV show Survivor in a monastery, you know, which one will survive? Which novice is going to get voted off the mountain, right? Only one of them makes it. So it's a very interesting book. To me, at least. But few of us, however, feel called to spend our lives almost exclusively in silence or solitude, though again, we have a lot to learn from those who choose to do that. But new scientific studies are coming out all the time that are heralding the benefits of spending more time in silence than most of us currently do in our frenetic, 24/7, constantly connected existences. Although I'm heartened whenever I see, and I increasingly do, see stories of schools, including public schools, you know, teaching yoga, teaching mindfulness to young children, as we do in our religious education program here. To take just one example of the benefits of contemplative practices, regardless of your age, some studies have reported neuroplasticity, right? So the brain changing in a good way in response to painful stimuli after as little as 4 20-minute meditation sessions. So in as little as 4 20-minute meditation sessions, people's perception and ability to do pain management is markedly different. Some mindfulness intervention studies claim to use mindfulness induction techniques, which could have been as short as 1 moment of paying attention to present sensory experience non-judgmentally and non-reactively. Just doing that for 1 moment, people instantly notice a difference. It's not as much as if you spend 4 times at 20 minutes. It's not as much as if you have a regular meditation practice, but the learning curve starts almost immediately, the neuroplasticity. And those words non-judgmentally and non-reactively are key. So what are you supposed to be doing in that moment or in that 20 minutes or 45 minutes or 5 days? Is you're cultivating non-judgmentally and non-reactivity. In the words of one spiritual teacher, the opposite of the contemplative life is not the active life. So it's not saying you either become a monk or nothing. So the opposite of the contemplative life is not the active life, but the reactive life. Are you cultivating a sense in which you can respond to things from your best self? Are you just living the reactive life? Spending more time in silence amidst your life in the world can greatly increase your capacity to be non-judgmental and non-reactive in even increasingly stressful situations. Not that you won't sometimes, you know, blow off the handle, but that's another invitation to learn. And we hear a lot about mindfulness, but an equally important practice is cultivating heartfulness in one's meditation practice, opening yourself compassionately to whatever arises as you enter into silence. And regarding what may arise within us when we actually slow down, which can be trepidatious, you know, what actually have I been repressing that might be come up when I take time to maybe remember it? The Sufi poet Rumi says in his poem, The Guest House, "This being human is like a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor." And here's the trick. Rumi writes, "Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." Rumi is encouraging us neither to repress whatever arises nor to fixate and grasp onto it. Neither to repress whatever arises into the guest house of this being human, nor to fixate on it. The invitation of entering into silence is to practice stopping, ignoring, and rushing past and our inner life, and instead to offer whatever is within us, hospitality and compassion and welcome, whatever emerges within you. But then, whatever emerges, to practice gently letting it go. Letting it go on down the stream of your consciousness and not grasping. Along these lines, I once heard a practitioner lament to the contemplative teacher, Thomas Keating, that during that last 20-minute period, I think I got distracted, he said, at least 1,000 times in 20 minutes, and it was terrible. But Keating said, "I invite you to reframe your distress and try seeing those past 20 minutes as a time when you had 1,000 opportunities and did 1,000 times practice letting go of what Buddhists call the monkey mind." So increasingly you're inculcating it, even if it's really hard at first. Just as a beginning piano student or an athlete is clumsy at first, you get better with practice. So too with contemplative practices, over time, your powers of concentration, compassion toward others and to yourself, and insight will be strengthened. Accordingly, I'd like to invite each of us to spend at least a few moments this morning experimenting firsthand with what happens when you immerse yourself in the sound of silence. Among the many wonderful contemplative practices in the world's religions from which you can choose, I'd like to invite us this morning to experiment with a Buddhist practice that is less familiar to many called Nada Yoga. Nada is the Sanskrit word for sound, and Nada Yoga means concentrating on your inner sound, also referred to in the Buddhist tradition as the sound of silence. Interestingly, nada is also the Spanish word for nothing, which is the way we're most familiar with hearing it. And to detect the nada sound, I invite you now, if you put your kind of feet flat on the floor, let yourself be relaxed but alert, rest your hands comfortably. So to detect that nada sound, try turning your attention inward toward your hearing. If you listen carefully to the sounds around you, you're likely to hear a continuous, high-pitched inner sound like white noise in the background. It's a sound that is beginningless and endless. Try listening for that now. You have a few more moments in a second to listen further. But I invite you, because I know some of you have thinking minds, to let go of any impulse during the silence to come, to theorize about this inner vibration and figure out what exactly it might be anatomically. Instead, I invite you to bring your attention to that inner sound and allow it to fill the whole sphere of your awareness. In a small number of people, the inner sound is oppressively loud. If that's the case for you, similar to what Sabrina led us through earlier, I invite you instead to focus on your breath if the listening to your sound does not work for you. In a few moments, we'll pause for about 3 minutes, after which I will ring the gong to invite you to return your attention to the room. For now, I invite you again, relaxed but alert, open your heart, and as distractions arise, practice letting go of them gently and with compassion. Whatever is seeking to arise within you, greet it with hospitality, and then let it go. Practice letting it go, and then return your attention gently to the nada sound. What happens within you as you listen to the sound of sheer silence? Those of you that might have felt within you call to listen more to the sound of silence in your life and to pay more attention to your interior journey. One other point I often like to make for people who are early in those sort of experimentations is that there can often be the impression that the only type of like Buddhist practice or Christian contemplative practice is silence, where you're just working on concentration. And that's just one part of it. There are also insight practices where you're practicing insight into the nature of reality, into impermanence, into mortality. In my own practice, I've been spending a lot of time doing loving kindness meditation. So not silent, but where I'm doing repetitions of like Buddhist metta meditations, things like, you know, may I be filled with loving kindness, may I be well, may I be peaceful and at ease, may I be whole, and then extending that outward, may you, you know, in the southern sense, y'all, right? May y'all be, you know, or one other person that you know you need to work on that loving kindness with, or, and then to we, and then to all beings. So, and then kind of spending 20 minutes doing that, so that there's a really wide variety of contemplative practices for doing the inner journey, and myself and others that I can connect you with others if you're interested in learning more about this. But for now, I invite you to continue your journey walking in love. Care for one another. Care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, know that whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace, of joy, that goes with you out into the world. We're different for having spent this time together. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.